Hello and welcome to Behind the News from my rural readout. You may be able to hear some bird song in the background. This is Doug Hedwin, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two segments up today. First, Adolf Reed will extend Behind the News coverage of the crisis in organized labor. And then just after the bottom of the hour, Yiannis Varoufakis will take a break from discussing the Euro crisis to tell us instead about Valve Software, a fascinating enterprise organized on anarcho-syndicalist lines that he's now working for. Time is short, but a few comments first. The English environmental journalist George Monbiot wrote in his Guardian column the other day that he was wrong about peak oil. Drawing on a paper by Leonardo Maggeri, published by Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, Monbiot says that it's now clear that we have more than enough oil to fry the planet. He's right. The paper itself is a detailed review of the world oil supply that shows plentiful growing reserves around the globe. Peakists derived great energy from a 2006 book by Matthew Simmons, which among other things declared Saudi Arabia to be over the hill. As Maggeri puts it, the kingdom has always made short work of its critics. In this case, over the next 4 years, Saudi Arabia increased its output by an amount equal to the production of Mexico and Venezuela combined. But the real potential for increased production comes from the U.S., mainly shale, meaning lots of fracking. This has the potential to make the U.S. the world's second-largest oil producer by 2020. If anything like this comes to pass, it would be an environmental catastrophe, the fracking itself and the burning of its proceeds. We are nowhere near peak oil, and that is the problem. Just after the defeat of efforts to recall Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, I wrote a piece on my blog, lbo-news.com, on how the loss should not be blamed just on Walker's rich backers, but also on the blinkered, timid, self-involved strategy of organized labor over the decades. This ignited quite a debate, including a couple of contributions from a rigid, unreflective union loyalist named Gordon Lafer, who, among other things, called me, very dishonestly, a left anti-unionist. I am not. My good friend Adolf Reed shocked me by coming to Lafer's support, although in a more polite way. We'll hear Adolf's side of things in a moment, but first a few more introductory words. As Sam Ginton, the former Canadian Auto Workers advisor, said in his show a couple of weeks ago, the labor movement needs a left that is partly outside it to provide context, history, analysis, critique. Urging friendly critics like me to keep our mouths shut, as Lafer did, or to be careful about what we say, unless we give aid and comfort to the enemy, is exactly the opposite of what labor needs. I don't see how we can have a better country without a revived labor movement. And I don't see how we can have a better labor movement without a better left. Right now, both are in terrible shape. The revival of each depends on the other, and the task isn't helped by zipping our lips out of a misplaced notion of loyalty. Okay, back after a musical break.
Now I'm a union man, amazed at what I am. I say what I think, that the company stinks. Yes, I'm a union man. When we meet in the local hall, I'll be voting with them all. With a head of a shout, it's out, 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 out. And the rise of the factories fall.
Oh, you don't get me, I'm part of the union. You don't get me, I'm part of the union. You don't get me, I'm part of the union. Till the day I die. Till the day I die.
As a union man, I'm wise to the lies of the company spies. And I don't get fooled.
I was part of the union by the Straubs from a very different era. My first guest is Adolf Reed, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and contributor to a series of polemics instigated mostly by my original lbo-news.com piece on the Nation's website. Adolf Reed. Welcome, Adolf. I guess we've got a lot to talk about. It's been a while, but the Wisconsin fallout continues to drift down from the upper atmosphere. You took exception to a piece I wrote in which I, in some part, blame the unions for the problem, that they are, from my point of view, just doing more of the same. You think it's unfair to blame the unions for the defeat in Wisconsin. Why is that?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. I mean, you know, one of them is that to some extent, unions have to keep doing more of the same, right? I mean, they've got to do more of the same with respect to taking care of members' concerns, not running too far ahead of their members, that kind of stuff. I think another reason is that, I mean, it's not clear to me what the alternatives were in Wisconsin. I mean, that it's not clear to me that it was, you know, I mean, well, I think I said in my little piece that the first defeat in Wisconsin was when Walker was elected. So from that point on, it was an uphill struggle. I've seen people, I don't think you were one of these, but I've seen, in fact, I'm pretty sure you weren't, but I've seen a number of other people who participated in this discussion, you know, make a big deal of the fact that at peak, there were something like 100,000 people in Madison and that, the union should have moved to convert, you know, that activity or to generalize, you know, that activity. And that's a lot easier said than done. And I don't know what, well, and I guess an alternative, yes, it was bad to pursue the recall and fail. I'm not sure that it's worse to have pursued the recall and fail than, you know, not to try to do anything. And I'm not sure, right, since the unions were the only institutions that had any capacity to do anything, I'm not sure what else they could have done, really.
From what I've heard, the unions actually had polling data when they started the recall campaign showing that it was not terribly popular. So they did have they did know it was an uphill battle from the first. But
right.
They had conceded a lot already. They were like, what, over $4,000 a year in wage and benefit concessions.
Right.
As soon as the mandatory checkoff was, dues checkoff was repealed, the AFSCME lost more than half its members in Wisconsin. So it's not like the union membership has been convinced of the value of the union themselves. I mean, a great deal of union households voted for Walker. Many union members themselves voted for Walker.
Right.
Why are unions so unpopular, both with the broad public, not just with the broad public, but with many of their members? What's the problem with the union, the labor movement, that it really fails so badly at even pulling its own constituency along?
Well, I mean, one problem is, and look, I mean, there are political and programmatic problems. I mean, there's no question that there's, how should I put this? Something of a myopic vision in the leadership of the labor movement about how to fight back against ever intensifying and advancing neoliberal attack. But part of the story is also that they've just been getting beat, right? And I mean, if you, I mean, the harder it becomes for unions to protect benefits that they've won from members in the past, then the more likely it is that more people are going to be disaffected. And yeah, I mean, I think it's necessary to take a more sober or kind of a sober look at what we can expect, what's even reasonable to expect to be the nature of the relationship between unions and their members, right? Like in any given local and any given international. I mean, only a very small percentage of workers and even members of even the most dynamic and aggressive unions are going to care, actually care that much about the union, right? And yeah, I mean, that's partly a function of the way that the collective bargaining consensus played out over the post-war period. There's no question about that. But nature of the game, in the sense that most workers, I think Gordon put this nicely, that union members are like normal working class people, except maybe a little more politically sophisticated, right? Or class conscious in their politics.
Only a little more. That means that the unions have done nothing or close to nothing in the way of internal education in the organization.
Well, I wouldn't say they've done nothing, but I would say that a lot of them certainly haven't done as much as they could have or as they should have. And partly that had to do with a naive and self-satisfied belief that the post-war collective bargaining regime was natural law, and they haven't been able to. It took most unions a long time to begin to take in.
But now it's been more than 30 years since Reagan had the leaders of PATCO hauled away in chains, so how long has it taken to wake up?
Well, yeah, I know. Look, I mean, I've been asking that question myself for 20 years, right? So, yeah, but that's, I mean, that's a part of the problem. But when you get down to it, I mean, I still think, that even a bad unit is better than no unit. Yeah, I don't think the left can be in a position, well, I mean, if the left is in a position in which we expect the trade union movement to set and advance the agenda for a left, for a political left, well, we've got a problem, because that's not what trade unions do.
Well, we're not even asking that. We're asking them to show them some signs of alertness, even, and they're not doing that.
Well,
the instinctive reaction to a political challenge for a union is to just write more checks to the Democrats and find some Democratic candidate to be the vehicle for their interests. In Wisconsin, the Democratic vehicle was a guy who was bragging about how tough a negotiator he was with the union. So,
right.
this relationship with the Democratic Party is failing. They've spent hundreds of millions of dollars on Democrats, and what do they have to show for it? I mean, we're not even like asking them to, you know, embrace Lenin, but, you know, we're asking them to show some awareness of the fact that this political strategy is a failure. And there's I don't see any signs of that at all. I mean, they endorsed in March before they even had to. The teachers union, which Obama's launching a war on, was practically the first union to endorse him. So what are these people thinking?
Well, look, I mean, to go back to Wisconsin for a second, I mean, you remember, you know, that the labor candidate lost the Democratic primary. Barrett wasn't the labor movement's first choice to go up against Walker. But, well, yeah, no, look, I know. And, I mean, you know, I mean, I spent you know, most of the 90s and a good chunk of the first half of the first decade of this century trying to preach that gospel inside and outside the labor movement myself. For one reason, I think labor and I mean, there are unions and unions, right? There are a lot of, you know, there's a lot of internal differentiation inside the labor movement, too. But, yeah, for one thing, I think that they throw money at Democrats because they throw money at Democrats, right? It's what they're accustomed to doing. There's something like an institutional consciousness, right? That, you know, for people who come up through that system, I mean, that's what they do, right? That's what, I mean, that's how you do your politics. And it stands out especially because the public sector unions have been, I mean, this has been much more the first, second, third, and fourth approach of the public sector unions than it was in the industrial sector, even the building trades. Another problem, though, is that there's always some immediately pressing issue that bears on concerns of the members or of the institution that's likely to be at stake. And that's even more likely to be true with public sector unions than industrial sector. But there's always likely to be some issue, right, that makes it seem that there's an imperative to do whatever you can do to get the Democrat elected. And frankly, in the case of the public sector unions, as we've seen with 1199 in New York, to get the Republican elected if you think he's going to win, if you can cut a deal with him. Now, I'm not defending that, but, and I mean, my view on that has always been, and we argued, you know, this all the way through with the Labor Party, that that's understandable, right? I mean, that's stuff you've got to do. But the frustration is that so few of them have been willing to put some effort on the side, right, 10 to 15% of the effort that they put into you're getting the next worthless Democrat elected into trying to build, you know, build some kind of alternative, you know, to build a base for an alternative, more self-consciously working class politics. And, you know, yeah, that's a frustration. But see, I don't think that frustration translates into, you know, the labor movement being the root of all evil in all this.
Well, no, of course, nobody is saying that. Well, how about the example that I gave? If the labor movement had spent a fraction of what it spent on Democrats over the last decade, it's like, what, $700 million, I think, is the total that they've given to Democrats since 2000. If they spent a fraction of that organizing around an issue like single payer, that would produce, that would really change the whole nature of political discourse in this country.
Right.
It would shift the balance of forces considerably if they put anything like that kind of effort. It would also improve their image with the broad public enormously. Because, right, you know, if you look at the Gallup polls, which I cited in that piece, much of the public thinks that labor unions just care about their own membership and don't give a damn about the broad working class. It's not the language that Gallup used, but that's what the language would use.
Right.
And organizing around something like single payer would be specific. It would could potentially deliver great benefits to scores of millions of people.
Yeah.
Yet they don't do it. And
right.
I think the traditional approach in the public sector of giving money to Democrats and getting recognized or fighting Republicans and hoping to get that the Democrat will win, it's just not delivering anymore. I mean, even in Democratic governments, you know, you've got Cuomo going after the unions, you've got Jerry Brown going after unions.
Yep.
It's not working anymore. I mean, just in purely practical terms, I mean, just in the most practical terms, not even in some kind of, you know, visionary or revolutionary sense, the old strategy is not working, and we're in need of a rethink. Is there anything wrong with my point of view?
No, I mean, not at all. Look, you know, I mean, Mark Badgett, was up here last night and this morning. Mark is, you know, the head of the labor committee for single payer, and I mean, that's exactly what he's been trying to do for the last few years now, is to push as much of the labor movement as possible in the direction of doing exactly the kind of thing you say. And it's, I mean, here's the problem, right? I mean, for a variety of reasons, it's proven very difficult to do it at the top, right? To get that message across in any concrete way. And by concrete way, I mean a way that turns into actual practice.
But the FL-CIO is officially on the record as being for single payer, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, they're officially, you know, like a lot of people are officially on a record.
Right. Yes.
Being in favor of a lot of things. Yeah. And I mean, in some ways, and I mean, this is a lot. I mean, this is something that one learns pretty early with trying to do politics inside the labor movement, is that it's very common to pass a resolution of endorsement as an alternative to do anything. But in most unions, this is going to have to, you know. I mean, the internationals are going to have to be moved from underneath inside their own organizations, right? And I mean, that's the way it's going to have to go, right? But the other thing is, I mean, you know, I mean, like any institution, you know, one has to tiptoe through the internal politics of the organization itself to try to get anything done, right? So it's tough, right? Look, it's immensely frustrating. It's a long-term struggle, and the pace of progress is glacially slow, and the pace is all the more slowly glacial in relation to the blitzkrieg, right, that's coming down the pike at us. But, you know, I mean, we can't, you know, that's just the way it is, right? I mean, it's, yeah, I mean, I find myself, you know, scratching my head. You know, my friends and comrades inside the labor movement do too at what often looks like a lack of perspective and imagination. And it makes sense to be frustrated about it.
Well, you know, how about that quote that I got from Bill Fletcher? Some top labor leader told him that it's better to be on the inside and not listened to than it is to be on the outside. I mean, is there some of that they just are so flattered to be the junior partners of the Democratic Party that they don't want to rock that boat?
Well, I mean, I think that varies from individual to individual. But, yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are some. But there's some cases like that, right? I mean, we used to joke about you know, back in the day when you could buy off a union leader for a signing pen and a photo, right? So there was a little bit of that. And it's like that with all the interest groups, actually, right? I mean, the public interest crowd in D.C. are like that too, right?
Well, yeah, the Center for American Progress is practically an arm of the Obama administration.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't thinking about them, right, because they are, right, I mean, they are like the paramilitary wing of the Obama administration. but I mean the others, right? I mean, there's this, and I mean, access, right, is like crack for that crowd, too. So, and I mean, you get access instead of payoff or instead of output. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where we are, too.
Now, I don't know if you saw or listened to the interview I did with Sam Gindin a couple of weeks ago, but Sam made several, I think, very interesting points. One is that part of the problem with the labor movement is that unions are, by their nature, sectional organizations, and they very structurally, by their very organization, interested or forced to be interested only in their particularly local issues, and you need some kinds of institutions, some kind of new institutions, that could extend across those boundaries, would have a broader outlook, which now seems, you know, essential for the survival of the labor movement. I mean,
yeah.
On present trends, there's not going to be organized labor in 10 years. So what do you think of Sam's idea?
And I agree with Sam, you know, completely on this. And I've read the draft of the piece that he's got coming out in the next issue of the Socialist Register, where he lays that argument out. Yeah, you know, I think that's consistent. I mean, definitely consistent with we're trying to do with the Labor Party. I mean, because that's what has to happen, right? There's got to be some. It doesn't have to be a political party, and Sam makes that clear too. But there's, I believe, I paraphrased him to this effect with his ascent in my little nation piece at this point, I mean, it's not just a matter of not having an organic connection to some kind of left would impoverish the labor movement. I think the labor movement is going to survive in the U.S. It's going to have some link to or some kind of articulated sort of relationship to a political left. But I think the other side of the coin, though, is that the left itself, to have some, to keep rocks in its pockets, has to have some kind of link to a labor movement.
Well, that would be true if the labor movement were a living, breathing force, but there's not much to it right now that one can sign on with.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's a it's the only thing we've got. Right.
So, well, we have virtually nothing, so that that just underscores the point.
Right. Yeah. I know. I mean, but that's it, right? And I mean, like I said, I mean, I think one of the reasons that so many people have been quick to lash out at the unions for the defeat in Wisconsin is that there's nobody else who can be identified to be blamed, right? There's nobody else who had any capacity to do anything.
I mean, there's a tremendous amount of wasted potential. They've got enormous human and financial institutional resources that are essentially going to waste. And, that's very frustrating and anger-inducing.
Well, yeah, sure. But see, I think the first step, or if not the first, but an important step, is to try to figure out, right, in a more textured and grounded way, why the potential's being wasted, right? Because it's a complicated story. It's not just a matter of the guys at the top, making fat salaries and double dipping or being spineless or being a version of Johnny Friendly, right? I mean, there are the more complicated institutional reasons, and we got to try to, and they're going to vary too from union to union. I think a part of the challenge is for people like us, right? I mean, it's boring as hell. A lot of it is, but to tool up more, to try to find ways to operate in that domain, to find the openings where it's possible to connect with people to move inside one union or another.
It's not helpful though when people like Gordon criticize people as being anti-union for undertaking such critique.
Well, look. I mean, like I said, I mean, I don't look. I mean, I understand, for good reason. I mean, how the left anti-unionism charge can be heard as like the equivalent of a red flag because it's a charge that's been used by pork choppers over the years against activists inside the labor movement. You know, I mean, I appreciate that Gordon dialed back from that charge.
I think it's really the way he feels, though.
Well, look, I mean, I think in Bob's case, I mean, as I said in the piece, I mean, if the position comes down to being that all existing or almost all existing unions are corrupt, and that we need to get rid of the Wagner Act, basically to end the corruption in the unions and to force them to organize, then especially at this political moment, right, it does seem like an anti-union charge because it's not because there's no way to I kind of recoil even from calling it reforming the labor movement, but I mean it's the challenge seems to me that's got to be to connect with people in the labor movement who are trying to push left programs push aggressive politics even in that context and start to try to figure out ways to work in concert, right? And I mean, I know Gordon would be he was frustrated and pissed off and he kind of flew off the handle a bit, but I mean, I know that Gordon would be open to that kind of being part of that kind of process. And he and I have talked about it a lot over the last 2 or 3 years even.
Well, I was really surprised to see you suggesting, you who are one of the more ruthless critics I know, and I admire and love you for it, to counsel people holding their tongues on criticism of the labor movement because it might end up on the National Right to Work Foundation's website. How are we ever going to get anywhere unless we can be absolutely honest and open about these ossified and often corrupt institutions?
Well, no. Look, I'm not opposed to being honest and open. I just don't think that that a venue like The Nation is the best place for it. And that's frankly as much because of the lack of your political focus among that broad, or I guess I should say the plurality of politics and of your political leanings in that broad public, I guess, that comes together around The Nation. I mean, I think these are important discussions for us to have. I'm not saying that they shouldn't be had. I mean, my concern is more at the venue.
Well, what venue is proper then?
Well, among other things, I think we need to, start trying to create the venues. I think we need to have like a broadening and expanding conversation among people on the left who have a commitment to trying to push the labor movement to the left.
Well, I was very cheered by the reaction I got to the original piece I wrote. I mean, I heard from a lot of like rank and file people, mid-level leaders, even an SEIU VP contacted me. There is a hunger for the conversation out there.
Yeah.
But it's not happening.
Right.
The labor movement itself does nothing to, the Economic Policy Institute, which it partly funds, does serious work. But there's not much in the way of thinking or of media that's worth reading or listening to that comes out of the labor movement. They're just not interested in fostering any kind of serious reflection, discussion, analysis, even data gathering.
Well, I mean, I tell you something. I mean, I don't know if you remember, but at that moment, right, the brief 100 flowers moment before the SEIU and the others split, there was a brief period in that moment when people from a number of unions put up very thoughtful and strategically grounded critiques and arguments. I mean, but what struck me then was that it very quickly turned to the kind of pedestrian pro forma arguments over how to carve up the money between organizing and servicing, right? So it's a kind of labor technicians debate that people got a lot more passionate about than it seemed to me. Look, I could see why it's a real issue, but it seemed to me like to a lot of us, frankly, that the larger problems, or the labor movement had larger problems that we needed to try to grapple with, it, a lot of which had to do with political strategy. And I think the problem was that more people felt more comfortable having, and this is, and I mean this to include people who are identified with the labor left, felt more comfortable parsing the concerns of the labor movement in a more syndicalist kind of way, where the real issues have to do with how much you spend on organizing new members versus how much you spend on servicing the ones that you have. And there is a kind of left, a kind of syndicalist technicism that I've associated with with what's sometimes called the new unionism that tends to put off questions of politics in a kind of a Linsky-eyed way, actually, I think, on the premise that building union density will solve all of the problems in the world. And, that's another.
Yeah, well, that was the Andy Stern perspective, and that's come to naught.
Yeah, well, or possibly worse than naught.
Yes. We're just about out of time, but the Bob Fitch approach, of course, is toxic to most people, including you. I think Bob tended to get carried away with things, and let me put his position in a somewhat more flexible or charitable way, which is that it's really hard to imagine any kind of rebirth of the labor movement coming out of the present institutional structure. Certainly not personnel. I mean, it's hard to imagine Trumka or Mary Kay Henry leading us to a better society. But even so, I mean, does it really matter? I think Bob would argue that it didn't matter really who led these institutions because they were so structurally conservative and ossified and just deeply screwed up. Do
right.
you see a way in which this present institutional structure could actually accomplish the rebirth we're talking about? Or is you can understand the temptation of wanting to blow it up and start over again.
Yeah, I can understand the temptation. And then I would find myself in the loving embrace of Grover Norquist and think, okay, I got to resist this temptation.
Well, you're a good Catholic, so you can say a Hail Mary and an act of contrition, too, after that temptation.
But, well, look, I mean, to be honest, I don't know. I mean, I don't see a way, but I am convinced that, and this may be my own lack of imagination, but that there is no other way, right? So we've got to find a way. And that's why I think, right, that the kind of conversation I was talking about a little while ago, and I've talked to you about it before, too, is the one we really need to have, right? I mean, we need to have a, you know, some venue, and I don't mean a physical one necessarily, but some colloquy, right, or something, where people with sharp left politics, with a socialist vision or at a minimum, right, or structural critique of capitalism or a critical understanding of capitalism's structural tendencies, right, start trying to crack this nut, right, to figure out how to connect with people who are open to that kind of thinking within the labor movement. And there are a bunch of them out there, and there are a bunch of them at the intermediate leadership level, and maybe some above the intermediate leadership level. And just trying to move one of these things is like trying to steer a battleship. So it's, so it really is a slow, tedious process, and it's a slow, tedious process that depends on stuff like building personal connections and relationships with people over time and moving them around and that's just what it's going to take. But it's also going to require, some kind of focused, strategic, political vision that's outside the trade union structure as well as inside the trade union structure.
Jose Adolf Reed, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and a contributor to a forum on the crisis in labor on the Nation magazine's website. For direct links, visit my blog, lbo-news.com, lbo-news.com. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break to talk about the contribution of video gaming to life after capitalism. Some of Daft Punk's The Game Has Changed from their soundtrack to Tron, Legacy. My next guest is Yanis Varoufakis. Yanis has been in this show many times to talk about Greece and the Euro crisis, but here he is to talk about his employment with Valve Software, a video game designer. Apologies for the sound quality. For technical reasons, I was only able to use Skype to produce this week's show, and while Adolf's sound quality was pretty good, this one breaks up some. Yanis Varoufakis. Welcome, Yanis. So you've got a new job with a software company. How did this come about?
Well, last November, I was going to visit the United States. And indeed, we met together, Doug, in New York when I was there on a lecture tour promoting my book, my latest book. Before I left Greece, I received an email which I nearly erased because it was an email from a video game company, and I have no connection at all with the world of video games, and I thought, okay, that's another piece of spam. But I noticed that it said, well, I'm the CEO of a video game company, and I've been following your Euro crisis blog. And I thought, this sounds interesting. So I read on, and he continued saying that when he and his colleagues at Valve, this is the name of the company, were trying to blend together different gaming interfaces. I had no idea what that meant, but it was interesting what followed. So while they were trying to blend together the different gaming interfaces, they suddenly realized that, oh my God, this is Greece and this is Germany. Two different gaming interfaces, and they were trying to blend them together with a common digital currency, which sounded to them very much like the euro. And then because he was reading my Eurocrisis blog, he thought, oh, that may not be such a good idea, so why don't I talk to this guy? So it started. He invited me to go to his company and to their company, actually, and consult with them for a couple of days. I said no, because I had a lot of things to do during that lecture tour, but then he insisted. I went, and it only took a day to realize that something weird and wonderful is happening there, and I wanted to be involved.
I know nothing about games, and I imagine a lot of the listeners know nothing about games. Why would an economist be interested in this gaming ecosystem, as they say?
I know nothing about games myself. And you know what? I'm not really interested in them either, even though I've been working with Valve now for a few months. I still haven't played a single one of their games. But I'll tell you what the answer to your question is. Because suddenly, when the first day, the first hour I was there, I encountered an amazing, very real economy. It may be digital, it may be happening in people's computers, but it's very real. In what sense? There is exchange, there is production, there is income generation, there is distribution, and that involves 90 million people, something like $1 billion, real U.S. dollars. That's like a small country. And
where do the dollars come from? People have to pay to play?
Yes, indeed. There are two ways in which, there's a variety of ways that money finds itself into the system. The most old-fashioned is you pay subscription, monthly subscription, in order to participate in a game. Then, once you're in the game, and now increasingly those subscriptions are waived and people get in for free, and then once they're in there, they can continue to play freely, or if they want to buy certain items that have utility to them during the game, they can go to the store, which is called Steam, and purchase those items. But beyond that, what's fascinating is that then, once they have these items, either through hunting, gathering, because they found them, or because they bought them, they can trade them. So you have a barter economy, which is created. And like in every economy, there is room for arbitrage. So people who are astute traders can actually make quite a bit of money, in the sense that they accumulate items which are of value to other players. And initially what they did was that they would get out of that platform and go to eBay and auction them off for real dollars. So you have hundreds of thousands of people who actually make a very good living out of playing the games, and hundreds of thousands of people, and that's even more fascinating, who make a lot of money out of producing stuff. So
what is produced and how?
Well, it's the same model as the applications, the apps on the iPhone and the iPad, the Apple idea, that independent designers can design an app and put it on iTunes, and they get a share of the revenue that Apple gets from selling that on iTunes. So this is exactly the same. Let's say that you develop a very beautiful hat that somebody wants to wear in one of those games. You can place it on the trading platform, Steam it's called, it's equivalent of iTunes, and you retain a percentage of the revenue that Valve gets. And as I said, there are hundreds of thousands of designers who make a very good living out of doing that. But the most fascinating thing for me was that you could actually see, that we economists, we have to make do with really bad quality data that is compiled by some statistical office, and it's like sausages. You really don't want to know how they were made, those statistics.
But then you apply very sophisticated mathematical techniques to very dirty data.
Oh yes, of course. This is what we economists do. And it's real rubbish in, dangerous rubbish out. But Valve, you feel like God. You're omniscient because you have access to everything everyone is doing in that economy at any point in time. You don't need statistics.
Yeah, now this relates to the old problem, the calculation problem that, the Hayek et al. Wrote about in the 30s, that we now have a lot of the data that's available in real time to look at an economy in a way that was impossible way back when, which makes all kinds of planning interventions possible.
Indeed. So imagine you have tens of millions of people participating in an economy, in effect creating it spontaneously in a way that Hayek would appreciate. But you know everything that's going on. And moreover, you can actually interfere. You can intervene. You can change the rules. You can introduce taxes. And you can experiment. And let's say that you're not sure. For instance, one of the things that you might want to do as a benevolent god or divinity in this world, you may want to prevent the formation of bubbles. Because bubbles, well, you have tulip-like effects. Suddenly some particular hat or machine gun or something, some item that the gamers take a liking to, start increasing their relative value exponentially. So that's a bubble forming. It's like tulips in Amsterdam. Now, if that bubble bursts, or when it bursts, some people are going to be burnt. You know, there have been items that were for sale initially for $2 and ended up being auctioned off for $2,000 and $3,000 and $5,000 and $6,000. So if you buy something like that and then suddenly it loses all its value, then you're going to be very upset. And one of the things, you know, you don't want as the game designer is upset players. The whole point is to have fun. So there is room for regulation, but now you can regulate. And the calculation debate that you mentioned between Oscar Lange and Friedrich von Hayek is neither here nor there, because you can actually do really controlled experiments that even Karl Popper would approve of. So, for instance, let's say that you have three different ideas on how to regulate it. You can divide the world, the global, this is a global economy, because there are people playing in Russia, in China, in Hungary, in Kansas City, everywhere. You can divide it in goals, in treatments, and apply different regulation regimes in these different treatments, and see what happens.
I know you're just beginning this, but are there lessons for the real world that you can see?
It's early days for me to give you a definitive answer as to what they are. I can tell you that there are. I can tell you that, for instance, the philosophical debate and political debate concerning free market versus the state. You realize by looking at this economy how bunk that distinction is. You can't have markets without a state, and you can't have a state without markets. So this is a false dilemma, and you can see this because these economies emerged spontaneously. No one created them. Valve and other gaming companies found themselves with economies in their midst. You know, these games were created by computer software gaming geeks. They had no intention of creating economies. Those economies emerged spontaneously. And yet, very quickly, those very same game designers found themselves in the role of regulator. It's not because they were, big bad government wanting to regulate free market activity. It was just without regulation, the market would collapse immediately. And another very important lesson that you actually see in front of your eyes evolve in real time is that when people are, to quote Adam Smith, tracking and bartering and exchanging and therefore creating markets and building up value, which is then distributed on the basis of demand and supply, how quickly that process, when unregulated, leads to instability and breakdowns.
So the market then is not a principle of spontaneous order as the Hayekians would have it.
Well, actually, there is spontaneous order. It's a very unstable order. Let's not forget Beirut, during the civil war in the Lebanon, did see instances of spontaneous order, even though there was no state for more than a decade and there were all these warlords fighting one another. Still, Beirut managed to function to have some degree of electricity supply, some water supply. It just wasn't a very good order.
And now, the company itself, though, is organized on interesting lines too, right?
That was the most astonishing aspect of it, and it's probably one of the main reasons, if not the most significant one, as to why I accepted the offer to be part of that company. When I first visited them, I had no idea either their products or the way that they were structured. And Gabe Newell, who is the founder of this company, tried to explain to me very briefly how the company is structured, its management structure. He said it's an anarcho-syndicalist company. And I thought, my goodness, an American who knows what anarcho-syndicalism is must be a very significant person, especially on the West Coast. And then I thought, okay, now pull the other one, as if it's, I just couldn't believe it. And it turns out he was right, sort of. Let me explain that, you know, what he meant by anarcho-syndicalist. He meant that, firstly, the company is wholly owned by a small number of individuals, mainly by him, who do not derive dividends from this company. So property rights are separated from revenues. Secondly, there is no hierarchy involved whatsoever. So no one has a boss, no one has a line manager, no one submits some ideas to a superior who has to approve them or not approve them. Anyone does whatever anyone wants to do. In this sense, it's quite anarchic. People coalesce into teams spontaneously and organically and on the basis of voluntarism, which is beautiful and wonderful. But at the same time, I can tell you, Doug, that it is a bit disconcerting when you first arrive at that place, because you enter the building, you know, you say hello to everyone, you know, some people from the process of being interviewed and being given the job, and then you're alone. Then you have to find out what you want to do, because no one around to tell you what to do.
So, it's like a kid starting up a new school, making new friends.
Well, kids at school have a hierarchy. They have a teacher. They tell them where to go. People actually boss them around. In schools, you know, grade 8 tells grade 7 what to do. In Valve, no one tells anyone what to do. It's astonishing. And you have to spend the first few months figuring out what others are doing by talking to them, by actually barging in their offices and saying, okay, so what's your role in this magnificent company? What do you do? And why should I be interested in what you're doing? And the answer is never, well, I don't care, go away. The answer is always very considered and responsive. And you get through discussing with everyone, you get an idea of what people are doing. And then you choose who you want to work with. And, for instance, you can send an email to everyone in the company and say, folks, this is an idea I have. Is anybody interested in working with me on this? And then suddenly, you get 5, 6, 10 emails, and then people wheel their desks next to yours, and they, you know, you're hooked together, and then you start working on something. And no one asks anybody for permission to do that.
Does this lead to some kind of hierarchy, unacknowledged hierarchy of the gregarious or charming?
Of course it does. I mean, look, we're human beings after all. You put three children together playing ball in the backyard, suddenly the hierarchy. I have to say that the Valve anarcho-syndicalist ideology is so deeply ingrained and fostered, I have to say too, in people's minds, that people make a very considered effort not to allow hierarchies to get in the way of the creative process. So, look, there are people who've been involved for 10, 15 years, you know, the first bunch that set it up together. Now, of course, you know, when one of those people has something to say, the rest listen more intently, especially those who've been there for a few months. But that does not mean that the oldies and the more senior members will get their way. It really doesn't. I've witnessed many occasions when the younger members would say, no, well, I still want to do this. And the senior member would say, fine, go ahead. And if you want to try it and you fail, that's okay. So the ideology is very important in maintaining de facto, not just the jure, the lack of hierarchy.
Well, finally, to use the jargon of the trade, is this scalable, do you think?
Well, this is one of the great worries that the founders of this company had, because when they started, there were a bunch of 30 people. They liked each other. They had self-selected with one another. Now the company is verging onto its first 400 employees. Those who had started it did not believe that it would be scalable beyond 100, 150. It is my view that it is working very well with 400. Surely there must be a limit to the scalability of this kind of organic, anarchic organization. But this is work in progress. We will have to wait and see at what point the costs of communication between 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 people are such that the benefits of the anarchic structure are overwhelmed.
That was Yiannis Varoufakis, resident economist with Valve Software. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the Kinks' Lola, the greatest song ever written about ambiguity, performed by the Raincoats. Till next week, bye.